received the similar gift from the elders, and there was also celebration. People coming to see each other, having food, and celebrating, and it was a great moment and a great time.
Nowruz was developed by Zoroastrians, but spread across the subcontinent mostly by Muslims. While in northern India, this festival's inception dates back to the Mughal era in western India. The festivity was brought by the Parsi community. It is among the rare occasions when arch rivals Pakistan and India congratulate each other. There is a shared positive sense about it.
The festival of Nowruz has a special significance in Kashmir. It's celebrated here with great fervor. Nowruz celebrations here date back to pre-Islamic times, but after the arrival of Islamic scholars from Persia who introduced Islam here, the festival gained importance and has become an integral part of our rich cultural heritage.
Such an aspect can potentially create a platform for more positive interactions among different nations and governments. It may come to serve as a friendly vessel for better communication between New Delhi and Islamabad.
Well, we can say that Nowruz is a kind of soft power we have in this region to connect the people of the whole region. If we say about India and Indian subcontinent, it is basically the region of celebrations, because we have different cultural identities, hundreds of the cultural identities, and they have their own festivities, beliefs, and cultural traditions. Nowruz was adopted and welcomed because it coincides with many of Indian celebrations. As I mentioned, Basant being celebrated in January, and Holi is being celebrated sometime in February or in early March, and similarly we have other festivities, and we have Zoroastrians here, the migrants, they are called as Parsis. They do celebrate it, Nowruz. Vis-a-vis, they also have their own Shahanshahi calendar that comes in August, yet they do celebrate in Nowruz on the same time, celebrated everywhere. And we see the variations also. And there are also the people in Bangladesh, in Dhaka, the Nawab family of Dhaka, in Hyderabad, in Gujarat, in Bombay, the Parsi people, even in Delhi. And for the whole Turkish period in India, that was for around 800 years, they had celebrated it. It was introduced in 13th century by Balban, who basically copied it from the Iranian tradition, and he himself tried to imposter himself being the descendant of Iranian great kings of Shahnama. So there has been a great tradition, and there is assimilation of the local elements.
The subcontinent has numerous regional and religious events survived throughout the various parts of history or mythology. For instance, Pongal is a multi-day Tamil harvest festival in South India, and Holi is the popular Hindu festival of spring. But for many, Nowruz has been added to the calendar because it covers them all. The multi-week cultural festival is a compact combination of feats and fetes that in other parts of the world are presented in dozens of holidays and occasions scattered all along the year.
Nowruz is celebrated globally as the symbol of life and peace, but people in many of the countries that celebrate Nowruz are suffering from extreme distresses of war. During war and peace, famine and plague, and even now with this horrible pandemic, people tend to find the moment to notice and admire the return of spring. Applied in proper channels, Nowruz may be helpful in more political aspects. Imagine weeks of spring holidays for all those undergoing some sort of struggles, skirmishes, or other conflicts. In almost all cultures and countries over the planet, sprouted seeds, like wheat and barley, play a central role in the ritual surrounding the return of life and end of darkness. With a cooperative spirit, Nowruz can bring light to the life of many of those who are longing for a blossom of hope.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Professor Syed Ainul Hassan. He's the Dean of School of Language, Literature and Cultural Studies at Jawaharlal Nehru University. Professor Hassan, welcome to the show. So, how can Nowruz play a role in uniting the people? Can it serve as a framework for better interaction among countries?
First of all, I would like to extend my best wishes to all sisters and brothers who celebrate Nowruz. As a matter of fact, Nowruz symbolizes a particular historical event. But that event is not just confined to one section of society or one sect of people. Rather, the message is too big and too vast. And you know, it was Jamshid who defeated devils, and people from all walks of life, from all over the world, went to congratulate him. They presented gifts to Jamshid. On what basis? Basically, it was victory of good over evil, and therefore, the world community, even today, is searching for some peace plan, and that peace plan can come after the defeat of evildoers. Those who have the best script and best spirit, good spirit, for them, you see, it's all right. But those who do not possess this, I mean, they should be defeated. This is the purpose of the entire world. And therefore, this is very much relevant today, that this message can only combine the entire community of the world together.
All right, so what subcontinental feats of culture or tradition have been added to Nowruz in India and Pakistan?
Well, this is somewhat a highly political matter. And instead of, you see, making any remark on this particular issue, I am purely a person, you see, involved in academics. I see everything through academics. But well, India has been trying very hard to acknowledge relevance of other people, other stakeholders, and therefore no country is left out. You know, our Prime Minister visited a large number of countries. And instead of having any kind of grudge, rather, it was very, very peaceful and peace-inviting visits. And therefore, I believe that Indian government will definitely move forward again and again in this direction.
All right, Mr. Hassan, before moving ahead, let's just please take a quick look at how the global media has covered Nowruz, and then we can continue.
Nowruz traces its origins in the Iranian and Indian tradition of celebrating the season of regeneration. The origin of Nowruz celebrations has been mentioned in various historical accounts all over the world, but mostly in Muslim countries, both in Shia and Sunni communities. Most popularly celebrated in Maharashtra and Gujarat, the Persian New Year is known as Nowruz or Pateti and marks the beginning of the Iranian calendar. The holy occasion of the Iranian New Year's Day is commemorated around the world by celebrating with the spirit of love, peace, positivity, and prayer. Nowruz celebrations are sometimes known as Nowruz Jamshidi. According to the myth, Jamshid was carried through the air in a chariot, a feat that so amazed his subjects that they established a festival on that day. Similar mythological narratives exist in Indian and Turkish traditions, while the legend of Amu Nowruz is popular in the countries of Central Asia. In the 18th century, a rich tradesman from Surat, Nasir Vanji Kuhyaji, who often traveled to Iran, came to know about Nowruz and began celebrating the day back home that brought the festival to India. In the 19th century, another Parsi, Murwanji Pandey, started celebrating the day in Mumbai after his wife, who was from Iran, told him about it.
All right, Professor, welcome back. So, people from different races, ethnicities, and religions celebrate Nowruz or some kind of festival for spring. What is so innate within humans that they feel joyful or elated with the change of season?
That's a very, very, you know, important question today. What is happening in all Indian festivals are based on change of season. And in Iran also, it is the 21st March or Awwal-e Farvar, means change of season from one set to another. But let me tell you, most important thing is that, you know, it happened, you know, during the ancient time. And people migrated to India, like, you know, Parsis. Some people say in 7th century and some say that later centuries. But what they did, they preserved their ancient culture. They brought their ancient culture with them to India. And similarly, during Balban's time, there were a large number of Persians present in at the court of Balban, the Delhi Sultan. And therefore, Balban also started this festival. What? It has, you know, basically a cultural root. And therefore, Balban wanted to combine all people together for this festivity. But later on, see, as people mentioned, and the historians also have mentioned, that it was Aurangzeb who somehow became more, you know, rigid and in terms of religious activities, and therefore he disbanded Nowruz. But today, you know, people in different states of India and outside India also, there are as many as I have learned that more than 40 countries celebrate Nowruz. So you can see the message of Nowruz and the importance of Nowruz. It is, if we confine it to the change of season only, then you see, it becomes, you see, like, you know, in Europe and America, there is a different season. And today, here you see in India, in Iran and other places, you see, what I say, the message is so strong, combining all people together. But yes, there is a community, like, you know, Shia community believes that 21st, what is the relevance of 21st March? They believe that this was the day when Prophet Muhammad announced the name of his successor, which, you know, which is, say, pointed towards, you know, Ghadir of Qum and what happened there. So this also becomes a relevance that, look, I mean, there is a change of seat, change of power from one to another. And very amicably, you see, there is a change of power. This is how, you see, you can find so many relevance, not one single. It's the first day of new calendar. This is also a relevance. In India, there is Holi, which is, you know, which will follow immediately after Nowruz, you will find holy celebration where people throw colors on each other to friends and foes, distribute sweets, exchange flowers, and this is the time when best flowers are seen, whether in Iran or India. So therefore, change of season on one hand, but other relevance is also there, that people believe that, look, I mean, this is the day when we should meet each other, we should greet each other, we should celebrate together.
So, Professor, can Nowruz be used as a way for friendlier communications between India and Pakistan?
Well, Nowruz, you see, there is nobody who can deny the role of festivals in, combining communities together. And as I said, India has been a peaceful and peace-loving country. And India always invites people to participate in festivities. Like, you know, who says that Holi is different from Nowruz? Holi gives similar message, where, you know, we find victory of good over evil. That's a message of Holi festival, where, you know, the bad thing is thrown to the dust. Then they lit fire and they cross, they go across the fire. You see, in Iran, they say Sulhi wa Zardi. Here also, they say that, look, I am for good. And let the bad spirit go to the hell. So this is a message. If Pakistan is accepting it, or in Central Asia it is prevalent, I think, well, one should make effort in order to combine the entire community of the world together, and Pakistan is not away from the world community. I mean, Pakistan, and if Pakistan is extending hands in terms of, you see, Indian festivals, if they say they want to celebrate, India will not stop them. You see, India will encourage them.
All right, now that was our special episode about Nowruz and its potential as a vessel of peace and symbol of life. We shall meet next week, and Nowruz Mubarak.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering a doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah,
who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear listeners, wherever you are, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer the questions with regard to theology or whatever goes towards religion and the beliefs of people, specifically the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, in order to discuss these issues with scholars from seminary schools. We have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to this session. I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. Dear brothers and sisters, the question that we started talking about, and it was received by a questioner, that some of the Islamic rulings and laws actually look like barbarian laws, and they are very harsh, and it is not going to be implementing justice in the society. Rather, it is actually propagating and promoting a sort of savagery. This was the question that was asked, and actually the respected guest speaker of the show shed some light on the question. But I think before solving such issues, we need to know about the philosophy of such rulings and laws in Islamic context. It is good to learn Islam from pure from the right source. The right source in our understanding is Al-Quran itself and those who are the real and true interpreters of the Holy Quran, that is Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So based on the school of Ahlul Bayt, we are trying to answer such questions in these series of shows, and specifically the question which was posed here concerning the harshness of the Islamic rulings and punishments is something that we shall discuss today, though it has been a little bit touched upon in our previous session, but we shall shed some more light on the philosophy of such laws in this session. Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools will help us to answer and clarify the point. Sheikhana, we're waiting for explanations.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We mentioned that, first of all, we are talking about the Islamic punishment for theft, which is, cutting off like four fingers, for example.
Yeah.
We said that, first of all, it's not including all the robbers and thieves. Rather, there are many conditions for them to be included in this punishment. Second of all, there are some ways to prove that. It's not only a matter of claim.
Mm-hmm.
Any crime should be proved for a Muslim jurist. Third of all, we said that although there is a discussion whether Muslims are able to implement the Islamic hudud at the time of the major occultation, and some Shia scholars believe that we are not allowed, but the majority of the contemporary Shia scholars believe that we need to implement the Islamic laws.
Mm-hmm.
But as we explained, they can be implemented only under an Islamic country.
Mm-hmm.
So Muslims have no right to act upon these laws if they live in non-Muslim countries.
Yeah.
But when it comes to this point, this punishment, we should think that Islam is not only this one verdict. Islam is a package of different laws which help the society reach social justice and oppose poverty and train the people and so on and so forth. So my point is that an ideal Islamic country is the one which trains all the subjects to know about Islamic laws and values. And then when it comes to economic issues, an Islamic country needs to help all the people to get rid of poverty.
Yeah.
So if Islam has such a punishment for a thief, the same Islam has many programs for the welfare of Muslim people living under an Islamic country.
Yeah.
So we need to take into account and into consideration all the Islamic laws related to this topic. The next point is that if we see that nowadays, unfortunately, the number of the people who are committing this sin are relatively more, maybe it is because of the fact that this Islamic law is not acted upon. As I mentioned in the previous program, we do not see so many examples of this Islamic law being implemented at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. We said that, first of all, one reason might be that although the punishment seems to be serious, but to prove that is very difficult. And second of all, it was because of the fact that Muslims refrained from committing that sin because the punishment was serious. So nowadays, some people claim that if you're going to cut the hands of the thieves, you need to cut the hands of, let's say, 10% people of a society. The answer is that this is not the case. If people come to know that, in practice, the punishment of cutting the hand will be implemented, then, even the majority of the thieves, they were looking for another job, an occupation. They are not going to continue to do this job. So if we have this sin committed by maybe many people, of course, relatively speaking, maybe it is because of the fact that this Islamic law is not acted upon. Now we have two issues. We have the maslaha, we have the expediency of a society, and the maslaha of one person. Imagine we have a city. In it, we have like 1 million people. They live in that city. If this punishment is implemented for one person, it prevents all other people who are going to commit the same crime. Yep. And I think it really happens. I mean, if really people are sure and certain about the fact that the punishment for all these crimes will be implemented, then if not all, the majority of the criminals will abandon doing those crimes. So should we take into account and into consideration the welfare and maslaha and expediency of the minority of the criminals, or no, the maslaha of the society? I mean, in communities where many people, unfortunately, they are engaged in adultery or, I mean, rape, for example.
Yeah.
If you ask the majority of the people that if we implement a serious punishment for the criminals, in a short term, the number of the crimes will be decreased. The majority of the people, even in non-Muslim countries, they will tell you that we agree. Why not? So what is done is to the maslaha of the minorities, of the criminals. My point is that when it comes to the Islamic hudud and Islamic punishments, if they are really implemented, then it is to the welfare of society and the most and the great majority of the people. But having said that, I need to explain another issue as well, and that is the fact that some people might ask that why nowadays in, for example, countries like Islamic Republic of Iran, some of these punishments are not implemented. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about, I mean, all the punishments, whether they are implemented or not. But we have another issue that should be taken into consideration as well, and that is one of the benefits of ijtihad as viewed by Shia school of thought, and also the concept of wilayatul faqih, the guardianship of the jurist. The point is that, according to the Shia scholars, sometimes if you act upon an Islamic law, you lose a more important maslaha or expediency.
Very true.
Let me give you an example, and I refer to a story which has happened at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
We know that. Sheikh, before you continue, who is the person who is going to distinguish this expediency?
The jurist, the Shia jurist,
the
most
guardianship, the guardianship.
Yeah,
jurist.
But in our country, for sure, we are acting upon the rulings of Waliyul Faqih, who, according to us, is the best person to decide about these issues, because.
Okay. I know you mentioned, but sometimes in the low levels, when it goes to the executive levels, okay, when we have a judge in front of him, the person who is accused. So, this is the judge who is going to issue the verdict, but the Wali al-Faqih is not available there. So does it mean that the Wali al-Faqih is going to make it countrywide ruling, or no, the judge himself decides to make it balanced?
I think in these cases, these issues, these verdicts are mentioned by Wali al-Faqih himself, and it will be implemented by all the judges in all over the Islamic, all parts of the Islamic territory when we live in an Islamic country. So, for example, when it comes to the Raj or stoning to death, we know that it's not acted upon anymore in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and it is based on an Islamic law.
Yeah.
So the Islamic Parliament, they passed this law, and it was confirmed by the Council of the Guardians. So it is nowadays a law in the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have alternatives for that punishment. Let me give you that story, yeah. And then I will complete the point. We know that for many years after, for at least 25 years, we had the caliphate of three caliphs, Abu Bakr, Omar, and Uthman, and they brought a new innovation in Islamic community that was Salatul Taraweeh, which nowadays is also acted upon. And of course, the Sunnis, our Sunni brothers and sisters, they also agree that it was not practiced by Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family himself. So at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, it was expected from Imam Ali alayhi salam to remove this bid'ah and innovation. And it's been mentioned by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that when Imam Ali alayhi salam entered the city of Kufa, he told Imam Hassan alayhi salam that go to the mosque and tell the people that Salatul Taraweeh should not be at least said in jama'ah or congregation, because it's a kind of bid'ah or innovation. Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam went and announced that. People hearing that, they began to cry out that, this is the tradition of the second caliph. And so it began to be a kind of chaos among the people. Imam alayhi salam informed his father, Imam alayhi salam, and Imam said that, okay, in that case, let them continue this tradition. You see, a person like Imam alayhi salam sees that there are two maslaha, the maslaha of preventing from a bid'ah like Salatul Taraweeh, and the maslaha of preventing a kind of chaos and division among the people. And he sees that the second one is much more important, so he allows the first one.
Definitely, the expediency of the Islamic Ummah is at the hand of the guardianship jurist, and also he knows best what is good for the Ummah, and it is beyond the Islamic rulings which are going to be practiced. And this is what we believe in, the in sort of ijtihad, which is life and continuously actually shows its benefits and blessings to the Islamic Ummah. Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, and your respected listeners for staying tuned and listening to us in QAnon and Islamic Beliefs. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamun alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Salaamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. How are you?
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
Brother Miqdad, one of our listeners has a question. She asked that both of my children are insisting that I should buy them bicycles. I told them that our garden is not big enough, and I'm not sure if they're ready to cycle on their own on the streets. Am I being too paranoid? So what do you suggest the mother to do here in this situation?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm sure it's a question that many of the parents would ask. Firstly, bicycle in itself is actually a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think we mentioned many times before that children need to be physically very active,
uh-huh.
right? And one of the things that they can, one of the activities that they can do is cycling.
Yeah,
cycling is
yeah.
a very good sport.
Yeah.
It requires strength, it requires ability, skill. It's actually quite fun as well,
mm-hmm.
And it's not as dangerous as it may sound.
Mm-hmm.
I have bicycle myself, and my children do as well. So definitely, if it's possible for children to have bicycles and they are able to ride them, then definitely it's worth having. Especially
yeah.
if parents have it as well. If
mm-hmm.
the dad has bicycle as well, then they can go on a family
yeah.
trip. Dad and father and children can go and ride bicycle
yeah, they can
together.
Cycle together. Yeah.
This is really good. It's
yeah.
a very good bonding activity.
Yeah.
And it obviously fulfills the sports, and obviously it also goes back to fresh air and nature and that kind of stuff. Because
yeah.
if you're going to cycle, obviously your garden is very small,
mm-hmm.
then you're going to take them on a trip
mm-hmm.
Outside the city or in big parks where
mm-hmm.
they can actually have free cycling.
Yeah.
Right. So definitely do so. If it's possible to do so, then I would definitely encourage buying cycles. I would definitely encourage taking cycles to on the rural sides and,
mm-hmm.
and the big parks and mountains and different outskirts of the
yeah.
cities to cycle
yeah.
with good fresh air and nature,
mm-hmm.
Exploration. These things really have a very strong impact on the child. They'll remember these moments when
mm-hmm.
they were cycling in the forest and through the rivers and the woods and the dry leaves.
Yeah.
And this is very precious
it's
for
true,
children.
Yeah.
So I would 100% encourage that to happen.
So cycling on the streets might not be very safe for the children. So it's the role of the father or the parents, so they need to take them to a safer place.
It depends on different factors. Obviously, if the decision over here has to be made by parents,
mm-hmm.
right? And it has to be a rational decision. If really the city is such that it is not safe for children
mm-hmm.
to be cycling on their own,
yeah.
Whether in the daytime or the nighttime,
mm-hmm.
Then definitely that's a decision that parents need to make. And
mm-hmm.
they can explain to the children that we don't think it's safe, and
yeah.
therefore we won't be able to allow you to cycle on your own, at least at this particular age. Maybe when
mm-hmm.
they become a bit older, then we can
yeah.
review the situation.
Sure.
So that's definitely there.
Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad, and your audience. It's time for a short break. We'll be right back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Islamic upbringing from IRIB English Radio. So, Brother Mughdad, let's carry on talking about the safety of the streets for children.
So, before the break, we mentioned about a rational decision that needs to be made. Sometimes, however, we make decisions, we're not too sure, right? Sometimes decisions are made on an emotional way. Like, I'm not ready for my children to go out on the streets and cycle on their own.
Yeah.
It's very normal for parents to feel like that. But it's important to realize that children need to start building this independency and this their own, find their own strengths, basically. And this can happen by allowing the space, creating the space for children. So I'm not saying opening it completely, but for example, on at times when it's not dangerous, let's say there's not too much traffic and you know it's quite safe, it's daylight, and you've done the rational part, so you know this, it's not dangerous as such, right? You trust Allah and say, for the growth of the children, this needs to happen, basically. So allow children to go. Now, it can be very small things. For example, to do one street, for example. They can't go too far, maybe 500 meters from the house. That's pretty much it. But on their own, basically. Both of them together, they can go cycle. And it'll create for them a sense of achievement, a sense of success. And it's very important that children feel that way. This is how their growth happens.
So, Brother Mughdad, what do you think about mother standing at the gate of the house and the children cycling in the same street? Is that a better option?
So, I was going to mention this point. Whilst mothers and sometimes even fathers might be kind of scared or kind of apprehensive about this, they shouldn't allow this feeling to creep into the children, because the children will then become scared as well. And you don't want to do that. Now, having said that, I'm not saying you should do it in such a way that you don't create any sort of concern in the child, because then the child will become overconfident and just go anywhere and be completely careless, right? That we don't want to do that as well. But if you stand at the door of the gate watching the children, kind of, if it leads to this idea that, no, this is too scary, I have to always be there, it doesn't have a good feeling. It doesn't help the growth of the child. Now, perhaps at times it's necessary, in which case it's fine. But if it's possible to allow the child to go without building a sense of fear in them. However, it's important to build a sense of responsibility instead of being careful of what they do. That's very important. So if you do allow them, then explain to them that this is, we're going to be able to do this, but there's a couple of rules that we need to follow. We need to take care of when we cross the road or when we do this. Or you make sure that they are aware that this is something important, that this is something that is not it's not like playing in the backyard or in the garden. This is in the streets now. And children actually would be able to understand this, and they'll be happy to take it.
So I guess like cycling, it also depends upon the timing. Like, you know, when the roads are empty, there's not a lot much traffic on the roads. Like, might be after Salat al-Fajr, the morning time, when the roads are empty, that time might be good.
It depends on the cities and depends on the parents and the children themselves. Where they feel and they have realized that this is the best time and place. Slowly, slowly, you can use this opportunity to give children tasks as well. As part of their, of making them feel important, making them feel that they are, have a presence in the house. You can give them important work that they can do, for example, by cycling. Or even by walking on the streets. For example, bringing the milk and the eggs, for example, right? Going to the groceries at the corner shop. Children who begin taking up these responsibilities, they actually feel very important, right?
Uh-huh.
And this is a good feeling that children have, and it helps their growth. So definitely encourage children, for example, use their bicycles as a tool,
yeah,
as a means of transport to achieve a particular important task that needs to be done. For example, going for groceries.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Brother McDowell. And dear audience, please stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, the child's playfulness in his childhood causes the increase of his intellect in his adulthood.
يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. And we have Brother McDowell with us.
Another thing about bicycles is that it's actually an expensive tool, right? It's an expensive thing that you buy in your children. And one of the things that comes with it is a sense of responsibility over it, taking care of it, right? And this is also very positive. It's part of the child's growth that they actually now own something that they have to take care of. You know, when they're younger, you then buy them toys, and then we don't really expect them to take care of their toys, and sometimes they break. But a bicycle is something you need to maintain. It requires maintenance. It requires you to check the air for the tires, for example. Yeah. It requires taking it to the garage from time to time to make sure that the service is done. Children who now have this responsibility of taking care of their bicycle is actually a very positive thing. It builds a sense of responsibility in them. Yeah. They feel a sense of achievement in them, that they're able to take care of something like a bicycle.
True,
right?
Yeah.
So encourage them to also learn the skills of bicycle. Use it as an opportunity to tell them, you know what, let's go for the service. And when we do so, let's talk to the guy and ask him to explain to us how the bicycle works and how I can at home take care of it. I can oil it myself. I can clean it myself. I can repair a few things here and there if necessary.
Fill the air in the tires. So, and if something
exactly.
Like that,
children feel a sense of achievement when they're able to do things themselves.
Yeah.
And it's my bicycle. I can take care of it. I'm able to fix the brakes, for example, fill up the air, for example. And this is very, very positive. It fills a child with a lot of confidence, a lot of positive feel of success, basically, that they're not just able to ride the bicycle, but able to take care of such an expensive thing. And they also have learned a skill here and there about how to handle bicycle. So this is part of the growth.
It's good that this thing gives a sense of responsibility to the children.
Yeah. Another thing that comes with it as well is a sense of responsibility towards themselves as well. So in most cases, if you buy them a bicycle, you buy them a helmet at the very least, if not even, for example, knee
pads.
Protections, knee pads and elbows and things. This actually, you're teaching them to take care of themselves. Right? And this is also very important, basically. Yeah. They're learning that I'm actually now involved in something that has a bit of a risk of an accident. And therefore, I need to take care of myself. And therefore, I have to wear a helmet. I have to not forget to wear a helmet. Not to forget to wear my knee pads. And this is also very good. And parents, gently, are encouraging their children to learn how to take care of themselves. And when they come to situations where they, where it involves a bit of risk, they've taken the precautions that are necessary. And lastly is that if in case accident happens, God forbid, and a child gets injured, for example, falls off the bicycle breaks, has an accident, child gets injured. In any of these circumstances, it's very important for parents to realize that they should be on the children's side. It should never be the case that that's it, from now on, no more bicycle, you're banned from bicycle. That should never be the case. On the contrary, you assist the child, realize what went wrong, fix the mistakes. If there's an injury, then help the child to recover. If the bicycle is broken, together with the child, build it again, fix it if possible. But make the child feel that it's a normal thing to happen. See, sometimes we make accidents feel like an abnormal thing in our life, right? Injuries as an abnormal thing in our life, and a kind of thing that actually makes us make rash decisions. Accidents, injuries, pain, these things are normal part of our life. Allah has made these as part of our life. They need to happen. They will happen. You tackle them in the best way possible without making rash decisions and without the need to stop bicycle at the end of this as well. If I had an injury, then I find out what the injury was. And if it's right for me to carry on cycling, I will carry on cycling. Accidents should not stop me from cycling, basically. Obviously, I need to take more precautions. Uh-huh. I need to practice. If I need to practice more,
yeah, that's right.
And realize where the mistake was.
Thank you so much, Brother Magdad. And the audience in this program were discussing that how parents should help their children in cycling. So thank you so much, dear audience, for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until the next program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Awaiting the global government of peace and justice. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam and heartiest congratulations to you all on a very auspicious occasion, which continues to be celebrated with enthusiasm by the faithful, whatever the circumstances, including the current wave of the coronavirus pandemic. Of course, with full consideration for personal and public health and full observance of the hygienic factors prescribed by medical experts. Today, the Islamic Republic of Iran and neighboring Iraq, as well as the faithful in our region and throughout the world, are celebrating the blessed birthday of the awaited Savior of mankind, who was born over a millennium ago and is in the state of occultation until his eagerly awaited reappearance by the will of God in the end times to end corruption and oppression on planet Earth by establishing the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. The concept of the Savior may be common to all religions, but it is only Islam which speaks of his universal mission. While it is the school of the Prophet of Islam's Ahlul Bayt or Blessed Household that specifies the identity of this promised person. Here we invite you to listen to Ayah 128 of Surah A'raf of the Noble Quran before we present you a special feature on the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi, the 12th and last infallible heir of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Moses said to his people, "Turn to Allah for help and be patient. The earth indeed belongs to Allah, and he gives its inheritance to whomever he wishes of his servants, and the outcome will be in favor of the God-weary." Whatever the Almighty Lord has promised will occur, even if it takes centuries to materialize. He gave the tidings of the eventual inheritance of planet Earth by the faithful and virtuous, no matter how long the wicked tyrannize his creatures who are indeed patient and have full trust in the divine promise. Note the contents of the ayah of the Noble Quran that we recited to you. It quotes the word of a prophet who was born through a concealed birth, It means the signs of pregnancy were hardly visible on the virtuous mother of Moses, peace upon him. Because of the grave situation prevailing in Egypt, further Pharaoh, having heard of the prophecy of the birth of a boy who would one day bring about his downfall, was slaughtering every newborn male that year. Today, we are celebrating the auspicious 15th of Sha'ban, preceded last night with fervent supplications in the divine court for the welfare of all mankind and deliverance from all calamities, including pandemics and the terrorism on the U.S. and other enemies of humanity. It is the anniversary of a Moses-like birth that occurred in the Iraqi city of Samarra in 255 AH, corresponding to 869 AD, where the tyrannical Abbasid regime had kept the Prophet of Islam's 11th infallible heir, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, under virtual house arrest. It was a futile bid to belie the seal of divine messengers, who had given tidings of 12 successors after him, the first being his cousin and son-in-law, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, and the last being his namesake, who will rise in the end times as the promised Qa'im al-Mahdi to end tyranny and corruption by materializing Moses' prophecy to the Israelites of the eventual inheritance of planet Earth by the pious. Perhaps many of the Israelites whom Prophet Moses delivered from ages of oppression did not believe in God's promise. Otherwise, they would not have forsaken monotheism and taken to the worship of the metal calf while Moses was on Mount Sinai, by ignoring the fervent appeals of his vicegerent Aaron not to indulge in such a cardinal sin. The Zionists of our own days, who claim to be Jews, but are actually of East European Khazari origin, with no connection to the Semites of yesteryears, also do not believe in what Moses had foretold, or else they would not have set up the illegal entity called Israel, which is the source of all evil today. The U.S. officials, whether Democrats or Republicans, similar to Pharaoh and his courtiers, have no faith in what Moses and Jesus had said, or else they would never support the Zionists, the slanderers of the Virgin Mary and her son, the Messiah, little knowing that Israel is all set to disappear from the map of West Asia. The Takfiris, who with American backing are currently terrorizing Afghanistan after having terrorized in the most macabre manner Syria and Iraq up to the outskirts of Samarra, where the promised Mahdi, peace upon him, was born, and where his father and grandfather repose in peace, have a scant regard for the words of the Prophet of Islam regarding his infallible Ahlul Bayt. The Saudis, who blatantly violate the laws of Islam and have recently disclosed their kinship with the Zionists, also deny the prophecies of their religious texts on the presumption that their illegal rule in Arabia would last with the backing of the Americans and the Israelis. If they were really Muslims, as they claim, they would have heeded Allah's promise in the noble Quran of the righteous inheriting the earth. thus the ayah of the Noble Quran regarding the prophecy of Moses, which we recited at the beginning of this radio program, is crystal clear. It is food for thought. It indicates that inheritance of the earth is not for the tyrants, whether the pharaohs of Egypt or the superpowers that rose and fell in various parts of the world, such as the Romans, as well as for the Americans of our own days. No wonder Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as is clear from numerous hadith mentioned by our Sunni brethren in their books, said that even if a day